nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker is our own Alyssa Panich, who is associate department head and professor in the Weldon School of Biomedical Engineering. And Alyssa is going to talk to us about designing research programs around unmet clinical needs.
So thanks so much, Jim, for the introduction and for inviting me to come speak with everyone today. So I want to talk to you a little bit about designing research programs around unmet clinical needs. And this is something my laboratory does, and most of my collaborators who are very translational in nature do the same kind of thing. And so I just want to start off with a little bit of information on why one might want to take this approach. And I've got data here for the United States because that's data that's very easy for me to acquire. But this, I'm sure, is true in other countries as well. And so between the 1980 and 2005, virtually all new jobs in the United States were created in startup companies. That's about 40 million new jobs, net new jobs in the United States. That's not to say that there weren't additional jobs in large companies, but the jobs kind of shifted around in large companies. So in the large companies, there weren't any net new jobs created. So really all of the economic growth in the United States came from startup companies. And so it's important for us as researchers, I believe, to support this kind of economic growth. Who is it that start these kinds of companies? It's really smart, creative risk takers. And I think we as researchers and as professors can help train people to, I mean, they're already smart and creative, but if we can really build that entrepreneurial risk-taking spirit in our students, I think it's a good thing for everyone. So what's also true is it really doesn't matter when you try to push technologies out the door. You don't need to worry about whether it's tough economic times or not. As it turns out, essentially half of all companies are started during bear markets or when we're in a depression. And so it doesn't matter whether you try to start a company now or when you try to start, or if you try to start a company in a large economic boom. If it's a good idea, you're going to be successful. So within the United States, we're very fortunate. We have a very large funding pool. It doesn't seem large right now since funding rates are so low, but it is indeed large. And the federal government looks at funding lots of different things. So they're very interested in basic science, but they're also particularly interested in translational science. And there's lots of reason for this, right? And we're spending federal tax dollars on science and on research. And the general public would like to see something in return for some of that money that's being spent. And so they'd like to see us improve the world for all kinds of things, right? For creative healthcare products, for better energy, for you name it. And in fact, the National Institutes of Health have created a new institute, the new Translational Science Institute. And so they're really focused on this idea of translational science. And this is true in all of our federal agencies. There's money set aside for translational science, for business development, but they still keep the single investigator funding because we can't forget that basic science is important and we have to further science because we need new ideas and new foundation to come up with some of these new translational products. So as university faculty, our research funding sources are primarily federal, industrial, and private. And really all of them have similar goals. And the products that we turn out are trained graduates, basic science, innovative discoveries, and jobs. And all of them are really important. And if our trained graduates can come out and work on innovative discoveries and really push them out to the market when they come out of their training programs, it's really exciting for them. So when I talk to my colleagues, again, who are very active in translation, they typically will ask the question, what problem am I trying to solve? So we're all experts in some area. I happen to be fairly good at biomimetic polymer chemistry, so I live in that world. And so when I think about problems that I want to solve, I'm really interested in the role that glycosaminoglycans, bless you, play in tissues, the mechanical properties of tissues, the physical organization of tissues, and in the extracellular matrix. And so when I ask problems about what I want to solve, I want to solve problems around the mechanical properties of matrices, the organization of those matrices, and how we can improve tissue regeneration using glycosaminoglycans. Well, instead of just saying, you know, what role does this glycosaminoglycan play, what I try to do is say, is there a particular disease state where there's an issue with glycosaminoglycans or proteoglycans? So is there some unmet need that involves these kinds of molecules? And if there is, how can my basic science approach solve that unmet need? So I try to drive toward what that need might be. So, for example, what role do glycosaminoglycans play mechanically and structurally in the extracellular matrix? Well, we know that the GAGs are a major component of cartilage, and they give rise to cartilage compressive strength. And as it turns out, the loss of these GAGs leads to osteoarthritis. Okay, so there might be an unmet need. GAGs and osteoarthritis are related. Is there a market for this need? Well, as it turns out, there are over 27 million Americans who self-report as having osteoarthritis. And this costs the U.S. healthcare system over $185 billion a year. So I would argue that yes, there's an unmet need. And so if I drive my interest in glycosaminoglycans in the extracellular matrix towards osteoarthritis, we might be able to solve that unmet need. So let me talk to you just a little bit about cartilage and what we've been doing. The main constituents of cartilage are chondrocytes, aggrecan, which is a proteoglycan, hyaluronic acid, which is a glycosaminoglycan, so both of these components contain glycosaminoglycan, and type 2 collagen. So the cartilage itself, all of you probably know this, it's located at the end of articulating joints. And it provides compressive strength to the surface of the bones, and it provides a smooth, frictionless surface. It lacks vasculature and nerves. So if you see here, this is histology of cartilage. The light pink background is a vast amount of extracellular matrix. A large component of that is the glycosaminoglycan. And then there are sparse cells within the matrix that are chondrocytes. And because of the lack of vasculature and lack of lymphatics and nerves, it doesn't repair itself very well. It relies just on diffusion of nutrients. And so if there's damage, typically that damage will propagate rather than seeing regeneration. We became particularly interested in aggrecan and its role within the extracellular matrix. So again, aggrecan is one of the major components. It has a protein core shown here with this black line and some globular units on the protein core. It has lots and lots of these straight lines here that are glycosaminoglycans coming off the backbone of the aggrecan molecule. And it has some shorter GAG chains that are keratin sulfate. These are negatively charged glycosaminoglycans, and lots of chondroitin sulfate, very negatively charged glycosaminoglycan. So what aggrecan does is it has this dense negative network, but it also, in the protein core here, has an amino acid sequence that binds very strongly to hyaluronic acid, which is another GAG within the extracellular matrix of aggrecan, of cartilage, and it forms this highly negative complex. And this highly negative complex then means that we have a collagen backbone here that's shown with these multicolor rods. And then we have hyaluronic acid molecules embedded within the collagen meshwork. And then we have the aggrecan molecules that are bound to the hyaluronic acid. And because all of this is enmeshed within the collagen, it doesn't go anywhere. And you have this dense, highly negative charge, brings in lots of water, and that's all held in there. And so it provides compressive strength, and it's in balance so that the water being pulled in is in balance with the tension of the collagen. So you end up with this very swollen network. In osteoarthritis, what happens is we have degradation of the articular cartilage. And this typically starts with aggrecan degradation, as we'll see in a moment. But what this leads to is very tender and inflamed joints, a lot of pain, and very stiff joints. And again, as I mentioned, there's 27 million self-reported patients with an annual cost of over $185 billion in the United States. So how does aggrecan progression work? The preliminary event, as I mentioned, is breakdown of the aggrecan. And if we see the aggrecan molecule up here, what you see is there are enzymes called aggrecanases that come in and cleave the aggrecan right here. And what that does is it releases the aggrecan molecule from the hyaluronic acid. And so it can then diffuse out of the matrix. When that happens, the hyaluronic acid in the that's shown here again as these white bars, and the collagen molecules are now exposed to enzymes as well. And so enzymes can come in and break down the hyaluronic acid and the collagen, and you get erosion of your cartilage matrix. Current treatments, there's lifestyle management. Physicians will often tell people you should lose weight, you need to strengthen the muscles surrounding the joint. There's a drug that's called Synvisc, which is a hyaluronic acid molecule that can be injected into the knee to try to provide lubrication. Or they can go in and actually replace your knee with essentially a metallic knee, metallic and ceramic, or metallic and polymer. And so none of these are really ideal therapies. And so in our mind, we believe that there is a need because osteoarthritis is a big problem. There's a market. As I mentioned, it's a huge market. There are no good non-surgical treatments. There's really nothing that helps these patients. And we believe that we can study proteoglycans by going after this market. I hope I've convinced you of all of those three things. So what we asked was, can we design an aggrecan mimic? So again, I'm a polymer chemist. And so I want to be able to mimic this aggrecan molecule. We want to be able to resist degradation to the aggrecanases because we don't want it to go away. We want it to bind to hyaluronic acid because we want it to protect that hyaluronic acid from degradation. We want it to restore compressive strength within the cartilage, and we want it to protect the cartilage in general against degradation that comes during inflammatory periods such as those that exist during osteoarthritis. So what we did was we set out to bind an aggrecan mimic that would satisfy all of these conditions. To do this, we started with chondroitin sulfate. That's the primary glycosaminoglycan of aggrecan. And we gently oxidized this. And over the past 5 or 6 years in my laboratory, John Padere has come up with some nice control methods for controlling the degree of oxidation of different glycosaminoglycans. What's important there is that we can add a heterobifunctional crosslinker, and we can add to the heterobifunctional crosslinker another molecule, in this case a peptide that binds hyaluronic acid. And we can very well control the number of oxidation sites, therefore peptides bound to the backbone of our chondroitin sulfate. And so John Bernard, during his master's work, went ahead and functionalized chondroitin sulfate, and he added either 3 on average, 7.2 on average, or 10.5 on average peptides to the backbone of the GAG. And so if he had 10.5 peptides on the back of the chondroitin sulfate, you'll see 10.5 here. GAH is just the first 3 amino acids of the peptide we're working with, so we know which peptide is attached to the chondroitin sulfate. And here's the name of the GAG, because in this particular instance, we're talking about chondroitin sulfate. So the next thing he did was, when he had controlled the oxidation and gotten the peptides on, he wanted to make sure it actually bound to hyaluronic acid. And this is actually quite easy for us to do, because you can just take a viscous solution of hyaluronic acid, and we can use rheology to measure the viscosity of the solution. And if the aggrecan mimic is binding to the HA, it should in effect increase the effective molecular weight of the hyaluronic acid and increase the viscosity of the hyaluronic acid. So he just measured viscosity using the rheometer. Or it increases the storage modulus, which you can measure at the same time. And so this data is actually the storage modulus. So the stronger the material, the more interaction between the glycosaminoglycan and the HA. So this is the storage modulus of hyaluronic acid itself. Interestingly, if you add chondroitin sulfate, the storage modulus goes down. We believe this is because of the net negative charges with all the molecules repelling each other and less chain entwinement. But as you then take this mixture of HA plus chondroitin sulfate and you start adding the HA binding aggrecan mimic, the more peptide molecules bound to the chondroitin sulfate, the higher the storage modulus. So you see more, greater interaction the more peptides bound. And so we can begin to understand how the strength of aggrecan binding to HA can affect, say, the viscosity of an HA solution. For the rest of the talk, I'm only going to show you data with the 10.5 peptides per CS, because at this point, that was the one we were most interested in. So this just shows what he saw. This is the control HA. We see a relatively high storage modulus. As we add chondroitin sulfate, the storage modulus drops. We believe that's because of less chain entanglement. And then again, as you add glycosin or the aggrecan mimic, more strongly it binds to HA, the higher the storage modulus or the viscosity is. So the next questions we asked were, we knew it bound to HA. The question was, does it increase the compressive strength of collagen gels that have the aggrecan mimic embedded, because cartilage is a collagen network with hyaluronic acid and aggrecan. And we also looked at shear testing just to, again, to better understand the interactions between the glycosaminoglycan and the hyaluronic acid. And so for compressive testing, we were pleased to see that if we looked at different strains, what we would see was an increased engineering stress. And so the red line is collagen itself. The blue line is collagen plus HA and chondroitin sulfate. And this is the collagen with HA plus our aggrecan mimic. So the presence of the aggrecan mimic, just like the presence of aggrecan, increases the compressive strength of these collagen gels, which begin then hopefully to mimic cartilage. We also see in oscillatory shear that the addition of an aggrecan mimic increases the shear stiffness of the material, which again is expected because we have more apparent crosslinks because of the interaction between the aggrecan mimic and the hyaluronic acid. So our next control step was, can we suppress the degradation of hyaluronic acid, because that's one of the roles of aggrecan, is to suppress the ability of the proteases and the hyaluronidase and the aggrecanases from degrading the cartilage. And so what John did here was say, if I take a solution of HA and I add an enzyme that degrades HA, I should see a decrease in viscosity. But if I have the aggrecan mimic, and that's shown here. So if we have HA, we add an enzyme, it should degrade the HA and we should get a decreased viscosity. But if I have the aggrecan mimic, it should protect the HA and the enzyme shouldn't be able to degrade it as readily. And so we should not see degradation into fragments. And again, he used rheology to measure the viscosity of the HA solution. And what we see is if we just have hyaluronic acid, or if we have hyaluronic acid plus chondroitin sulfate and he adds a large excess of hyaluronidase, before he can even get it onto the rheometer surface, it's all degraded. So in less than 3 minutes, the high molecular weight HA is degraded into small fragments. However, in the presence of 75:1 of the aggrecan mimic to HA, and there would be 100:1 aggrecan to HA in the body, so he used a little bit less than normal concentrations, we see a dramatic decrease in the degradation of the HA. And again, this is in the presence of a huge excess of hyaluronidase. You know, it took minutes to degrade all of the HA in the absence of the aggrecanase. And so he was very pleased to see that he could suppress the degradation of the HA as well. So the conclusions from this part is that he was successfully able to attach hyaluronic acid binding peptides to chondroitin sulfate And these actually are not susceptible to degradation by the agrokinases. So things that would normally degrade agrican don't degrade these mimics. He was able to show that he could mimic many of the properties of the agrican proteoglycan in that they bound to hyaluronic acid. They retained water and increased the compressive strength of collagen networks that had hyaluronic acid and the agrican mimic embedded within them. And he was able to suppress the degradation rate of the HA. And he's able to suppress that in the entire complex as well, not just in an HA solution. So, you know, we're very hopeful about this molecule. We've been able to patent it. We're starting to go into animal studies as well to see how far it'll diffuse into cartilage in vivo if it's injected into the joint space. So just to give you an additional example, which many of you have seen already, because I talked about this with you last year in Korea, but that was how do GAGs affect the mechanical properties and architectures of collagen-rich tissues? Well, in this case, we were interested in Decorin, which is a small leucine-rich proteoglycan. It has one protein core and one dermatin sulfate side chain, and it controls collagen organization and degradation. It's present in fetal skin. It's present in healthy elderly adult skin. It's not present in skin once you're a little over, say, a year old, and not until you're much older. And so it's downregulated in skin that scars. If you look at many scientific articles, what you find is fetuses don't scar, and healthy elderly adults don't scar. And so we thought there was some correlation between the Decorin presence, its ability to organize and protect collagen, and scarring. And so in this case, what we did was we took a dermatin sulfate polysaccharide, controlled its oxidation, attached peptides that in this case bind collagen type 1, and looked at their ability to suppress scarring in skin. Through this, and we did indeed find that a single application of this, at the time of closure of an incision prevents scarring. And so this is untreated, this is treated, this is the scar in an untreated animal, this is the lack of scar in a treated animal. And so, we were able to start to understand the role Decorin plays in healthy animals, how we could begin to mimic that activity, how Decorin controls collagen assembly, how it protects it from extracellular matrix degradation, all through making mimetics that go after preventing scarring. So another example of how one can do this and go after products that you might be able to take to market. So, this is indeed now on its way to becoming a product called Pelagen. It reduces visible scarring, produces stronger skin, and fits in with current clinical practice, and so we're particularly excited about it. The one thing that we do have issues with, well, we're able to say this is an unmet clinical need, and we're able to think about how to use glycosaminoglycans to solve that need in the way they naturally function within the extracellular matrix. What we don't necessarily have are good drug delivery vehicles. And so we have this really cool molecule that protects cartilage and could potentially go in even after initial damage. So just after you tear your meniscus, just as you notice you're getting osteoarthritis, we can inject it into the joint space and have it start to integrate into the cartilage and protect the existing or remaining cartilage, but we can only inject it into the joint space, and it'll only last for so long. And people aren't going to want to go in for, say, weekly injections of this stuff into the joint space. That would be really painful. And so one of the huge unmet needs that I see is the need for drug delivery vehicles for these kinds of biologic and biomimetic molecules. And so we need help in designing controlled release mechanisms that are stable within the joint space and can sit in there and not damage or further damage the cartilage surfaces as the person is walking or moving their arm, et cetera. So there's a huge need there, or potentially a need for targeted delivery where you have some sort of nanoparticle that's stable in the blood that can circulate and diffuse into, in this case, say, the cartilage space. But one can imagine wanting to deliver these types of molecules to multiple different places. So again, any kind of help with with controlled delivery and increasing the stability of these kinds of molecules is hugely needed. So with that said, I want to acknowledge funding from the Purdue University Scholars, funds from a Chappelle grant. John Bernard did all of the Agrican mimic work. Shaili Sharma has picked that up and is continuing on that to show it diffuses into cartilage and to expand on stability and binding. And these other people worked on the Decorin mimics. And then these are great collaborators who have impacted the work tremendously. With that, I'd like to end, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Okay. Well, thank you all very much.